In 1962, director David Lean and star Peter O'Toole gave the world a five-course meal of a drama full of rivalries, ambition, war, impassable desert, and of course, camels. Lots and lots of camels.
In 2022, we finish out a flight from a famous Irish whiskey maker.
The film is Lawrence of Arabia.
The whiskey is Bushmills Black Bush.
And we'll review them both. This is
the Film and Whiskey Podcast.
Welcome to the Film and Whiskey Podcast, where each week we review a classic movie and a glass of whiskey. I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And this week we are kicking off three films by the director David Lean. We're going out of chronological order, as you'll come to see. And we're actually going in reverse chronological order because we are looking at one of the most famous, highly regarded, universally praised movies of all time. Currently sits, I believe, at number 5 on the AFI's 100 Greatest Films of All Time list, and we had not gotten around to it. I'm talking about Lawrence of Arabia. Brad, this is a pretty monumental episode for us.
Yeah, it is the longest movie we have watched in Film and Whiskey podcast history.
It's so long. It is such a long movie.
It just keeps going. And then, like, it's not even like the Return of the King problem where you think that there's a lot of endings. Like, I don't know. I think you could have stopped this movie after an hour and people would have been like, yeah, that was a full movie.
Yeah.
And you could have done the same thing an hour and a half, two and a half, three and a half. But for some reason, he chose 3 hours and 47 minutes to be, you know what, we're done now. I'm over it.
We're closing the book now. This is where we end it. You know what? A good place to start today might be talking about long movies, because I'm going to be real with you, Brad. I have lots of thoughts on this movie, but I really struggled to kind of put them down on paper and form a coherent structure for this episode. Usually I have, you know, oh, I'm going to talk about this, and then that will lead into this, and we put together the bones of an episode. I just feel like I have so many disparate thoughts going on in my mind that we're just probably going to talk and they'll get shaken loose at some point. But since we're already on the topic of long movies, this really inspired in me a tension, I guess, about, like, what's it going to be like to try to explain long movies to someone who's coming of age now when there really isn't a utilitarian need to make a long movie anymore. Like, everything is serialized. Everything is made for Disney Plus, and they make it in, you know, 8 half hours or 40 minutes or whatever length. And then you get these little mini seasons of a show. And so instead of telling one long movie, even like things that could be a 2.5 hour movie are now made into like 4-part mini series that they show on Hulu. Everything is serialized now. And it's because you have the opportunity to stop and rewatch and go back. And you didn't have that in 1962. And so the idea of a long movie, I mean, like, it's got to be hard to even explain why people were interested in that to, you know, like a teenager today.
It would be like telling them, like, hey, like, you know that TV show Sherlock that's really good? Like, just watch 3 episodes in a row without stopping or, like, turning it off or taking a break. And that's what it would be like to watch Lawrence of Arabia in theaters.
You get 10 minutes to get up and walk around and pee, and then you got to come back and watch more.
I don't even know if it was 10 minutes, dude. I think it was, like, 5 or 6.
Yeah. It's you really got to make sure there's no line. Like, you gotta make a beeline for the bathroom, pee, and then immediately run back to the theater.
Yeah, Bob, I think that long movies really are a dead art form.
Yeah, I just don't see this ever coming back.
Like, Lord of the Rings is the last movies I can think of that were wildly popular and longer than 180 minutes.
Well, like, I mean, even with the Hobbit movies, you know, the first two are, you know, the first one's 3 hours. The second one is almost 3 hours. And then the third one, first of all, you could tell that they had stretched the plot too thin and they really had just run out of things to say. But I think that movie is only like 2 hours and 20 minutes. And it's by far the shortest in that sort of Middle Earth saga. But, mm-hmm. you know, the Return of the King really was the last movie that did this. And from that point on, studios started to get a little bit wiser about squeezing money out of people. And so, you know, the last Harry Potter movie gets split into two movies instead of being mm-hmm. one long movie. And mm-hmm. then they do that with every successive IP. The Hunger Games, two movies at the end. You know, Twilight, two movies at the end. Everything gets two movies.
And wildly successful franchise, Twilight.
Hey, listen, man, I didn't say it was good, but it was definitely successful.
They made a lot of money off of it.
You can trace the direct lineage from Lawrence of Arabia all the way through to the Twilight films, is what I'm
saying.
You
sure can. They are both movies.
Yeah, I don't know, man. I've just been thinking about, like, it's really interesting as we talk about our movie theaters going to die, our movies going to die, is everything just going to get replaced with TV shows now? Because we have no need to go out and watch a long form version of this. And
how long
I think
was Dune.
What's that?
How long was Dune?
Dune was like two, like just a little over 2.5. It felt like okay. three. Like it's a big movie and it has yeah. a lot of this going on in it. But it also, I mean, it didn't crack the 3-hour mark. So you just don't have movies like this anymore. And I understand, like, it's one of those things where, would it be cool to have an epic movie every now and then that is just a freaking long movie? Yes, it would. But even as a guy who loves cinema and loves the idea of that, it's like, that's a hard sell.
Yeah, I'm curious, Bob. Are you upset that the long form film, you know, 3+ hour movie is a dying, if not dead breed?
I think that yes and no. Like, I don't miss having my entire day taken up by a movie anymore. And it is really nice to be able to watch a movie like this in multiple chunks, like on my couch. But there is something about, like, when you get a 3.5-hour movie, you don't usually get a 3.5-hour movie that's about, like, two people walking gently through the English countryside. Like, it's there is an eventness about it. And, yeah. like, we have event movies still. Like, I would say Dune was a great one where, like, I walked into that movie knowing the scope and the scale of this is going to be massive. But even then, it was like, man, if this had been made 10 years earlier, would they have given Denis Villeneuve the leeway to make it be 3 hours and 15 minutes? Like, could this have been a Titanic length movie instead of a Gladiator length movie? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah, I would, but I've never heard of that movie, so... Don't feel like anybody's ever told me about it.
I mean, I guess we are. Hey, we're getting Avatar 2 is coming out in a couple weeks here. And yeah. the official runtime on that is like 3 hours and 15. So,
okay.
Jimmy, our boy yeah. Jim Cameron is trying real hard to bring it back.
Yeah, I was going to say, we'll see how much that resonates with the public. I still am not sure why the original Avatar was such a hit. But we'll see if it maintains its cultural cachet, if you will. I really just don't see it holding up very well.
All right. Well, how does this all apply to Lawrence of Arabia? I guess we have to address that at some point since that's the film of the day. So let's take a step back. Let's transition to Brad Explains. This is the part of the podcast where Brad breaks down the plot of the movie that he has just seen, often for the first time. Brad, this was your first time seeing Lawrence of Arabia, right?
It sure was, yeah.
Do you think that, whatever your opinion of the movie overall, do you think that it's better that we watched this movie like in season 6 than if we had watched it in season 1?
Yeah, I think that, well, I don't know, because this is the kind of movie I grew up watching.
Mm, okay.
Just not necessarily a 3-hour one. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like what this really feels like a lot of different Westerns. Like, honestly, as we were watching this, I was thinking about The Searchers, mm-hmm. and, you know, and I know that The Searchers was obviously a big influence on David Lean, but, or wait, was it the other way
No,
around?
You're right. It was. He watched it a ton to prepare for how to shoot this movie.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it really reminded me of a lot of Westerns. So honestly, I think I would have gotten along just fine with it. The length would have gotten me a little bit.
Yeah. Well, I think this is like one of those movies, and we'll get into talking about it. I'm already stepping on Brad Explains here, but it's one of those movies where, like, you remember how big and how long and how epic the scope is. But when you get into the nitty gritty of watching the movie, like, it's a very interior movie. And there's not a lot of dialogue, and there's a lot of time to ruminate on the themes that are going on in the movie. And so it's a much smaller movie told on a really, really big scale. And I wonder, like, if that would have been as effective when we first started diving into movies in season one as it is now that we've got, you know, 200 under our belts here. But yeah, I guess we'll find out, because it's time for us to put 60 seconds on the clock here. Brad is going to try to break down the plot of this film. All right, you got 1 minute and go.
Lawrence of Arabia is a film, a loose biopic of a man named T.E. Lawrence, who is a British officer who somehow was able to unite the disparate, warring, rivalry-ridden tribes of Arabia and worked with them so that they could fight off the Turkish invading force. This was set in probably 1918 or 1919 during World War I, and he was massively successful in his venture. He saves the lives of a lot of Arabians. He leads them in battle. He blows up trains. There's all sorts of, like you said, Bob, it's an interior movie. It's showing how T.E. Lawrence really struggled to understand who he was in this world and what he wanted to be and where he wanted to lead them and if he would be able to do it. And it is the very definition of an epic film.
Yes. All right, I want to focus in a little bit on Lawrence as a character, because if there is still one part of this movie I struggle with, it's that the movie kind of hinges on the fact that nobody, including Lawrence himself, really understands Lawrence's motivations. And so because he is an enigma to everyone, it's really hard to portray that on film, especially when you're being asked to follow this character's arc over 4 hours. And I'll admit, I think every once in a while it really tried my patience. And the length of the movie didn't try my patience. The pace of the movie didn't try my patience. It was the fact that I couldn't tell if Lawrence was a hero or a villain or simply meant to be a complicated character. And I think obviously, you know, at the end of the movie, it's kind of like Citizen Kane in that way, where everyone has their opinion of him and no one truly knows him. But I found Lawrence himself to actually be a far less compelling character than someone like Charles Foster Kane, who, you know, for all of his flaws, was at least very charismatic. And T.E. Lawrence is not that. And so it was a struggle for me to sympathize, to even at some point, like, expend the energy to try to understand this character, because after a while it was, I don't know, it just like it, the futility of trying to understand this character really set into me. And that led to some aggravation, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, I am 100% with you, Bob. I think that the beauty of Kane in, you know, in Citizen Kane is the fact that he gives you just enough of a backstory that you feel the tension of his childhood propelling him on to do great things. Whereas, like, with Lawrence, it doesn't feel like there's any real motivation for him to do the things that he's doing. He just kind of gets really riled up randomly about random things, and then gets really down on himself and depressed and feels like he can't do anything right. Mm-hmm. And then all it takes is one person to be like, "But Lawrence, you can do it." And he's like, "Oh, I never thought of it that way before."
He's like, "I am a god." Like, it's very up and down existence for T.E. Lawrence.
Yes. And I, like, honestly, it felt weirdly prescient of the mental health crisis that we have in the U.S. now.
I don't mean to laugh, like, but yes.
Like, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. Watching him felt like a very honest portrayal of somebody who is struggling with their mental health and has times of manic activity and then long periods of depression and, you know, everything in between. And yet while he is doing all of this, he's also, you know, gathering a war band of Arabian warriors and, like, destroying the Turkish forces in the area and aiding the British push against the Turks. And it's just, it's a wild plot that I'm like, I can barely believe as the audience member, you know?
So I think maybe this is a good place to talk about some of the subtext of the movie. Usually we get into this kind of stuff in the back half, but because like the movie is called Lawrence of Arabia, right? It is about him. And it's not even so much about what he does as it tries to be a movie about who he is or the unknowability of who he is. And because of that, you know, it's been widely speculated forever that Lawrence was homosexual. And obviously they can't portray that in a movie in 1962, at least not overtly. There are definitely some scenes that suggest it. And there's obviously a scene, you know, in the last hour of the movie where he's captured by the Turkish forces and the Turkish Bey is very obviously wanting to rape him and probably does rape him. And it affects Lawrence's psyche for a good portion of the film after that. So there's definitely like, there's a lot of homosexual subtext going on in this movie. And David Lean even says, you know, I tried to suggest that he may have a relationship with these two young boys that he was taking across the desert. And maybe him and this character, Sheriff Ali, had a romantic relationship. And all, you know, I don't want to set that aside, but they use that subtext to drive home the point that Lawrence doesn't belong anywhere and that he feels like an outsider wherever he goes. And that no amount of adulation from people, no amount of conquering, you know, being a conquering force, no amount of building himself up into a god, no amount of self-hatred makes him feel like he understands himself. And so the homosexual component of the movie is used to reinforce that. And again, I really like that they're using those themes to reinforce the larger theme, but it never feels like it goes anywhere. It's a very sad movie. Like this guy just is doomed to never feel like he belongs anywhere. And that's kind of like the last image of the movie. I don't know. I feel like there's no closure to the film. And because it leaves you with that open-endedness and that sort of like, oh, we're not going out with a bang, we're going out with a whimper here at the end of the film. Mm-hmm. I've just always really struggled with those decisions. Not that they're wrong, but they just don't always work for me.
Well, and that's why I think you have the opening of the movie is him, you know, riding his motorcycle in the English countryside. And he's still like pushing the envelope, pushing the limits because he's not comfortable with where he's at. He's, mm-hmm. you know, always has to be flying forward into the future. And I think that the thing that people remember about Lawrence of Arabia isn't really much of anything what we've talked about so far. It's the desert.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Like that's what you remember about Lawrence of Arabia. But I think that what Lean tried to do, and I think it's something he does extraordinarily successfully, is to say that, like, you can never predict what the desert will do. You can't understand the difficulties of living in such an arid terrain mm-hmm. until you've been there. And even once you've been there, you like, the Arabians that he works with continually tell him, like, you are crazy. You don't understand the desert. No one can understand the desert. Like, it will kill you before you come to know it.
Yeah.
And I think that it's a obvious metaphor for T.E. Lawrence himself. Like, he is completely unknowable, even to himself. He can't figure out the things that he does.
Yeah.
And so I think that the way Lean pairs those two themes and, you know, kind of entwines them into one driving force for the film is really admirable.
For sure. And I think, like, if there is another theme to the movie, like, there's that theme of this complicated character who is ultimately unknowable. And this is really like a scathing indictment of Britishness, if I can call it that. Like, it's a really interesting takedown of colonialism and the British sensibility and the sort of like two-facedness that I think David Lean sees in the British sensibility. Mm-hmm. And I really like the movie kind of takes on many different forms as it goes along. Like, it's an adventure movie, and then it's a drama, and then it's like a very different kind of drama, and then you get into political intrigue and diplomacy. And in the last like half hour of the movie, it really clicks into focus that Lawrence has been used as a pawn by the British government. And I mean, you kind of see that coming as a viewer. They talk about it for most of the movie, and Lawrence himself doesn't realize he's falling prey to that. Mm-hmm. But there's also the reveal that he's kind of been being used as a pawn by the Arabians as well. And that there's this great line that Alec Guinness has at the end of the movie where he basically says, like, you know, if we're being frank, aren't we both glad to be rid of him? And this man who has poured himself into what he sees as like his crusade and his destiny has ultimately just been used to accomplish the ends that he never wanted to have accomplished in the first place. And so, like, I wasn't expecting this movie to have as much kind of like, you know, we talk about Lawrence having self-loathing. I think Lean kind of has self-loathing toward his own Britishness. And it really kind of comes out here in this movie. And I say that especially because next week we're watching his other Best Picture winning film, The Bridge on the River Kwai. And it was really cool to watch these like on back to back days because there's so much in common there. And there's that same kind of sensibility of like Britishness is weird and needs to be exposed for what it is. And to all of our British listeners, like I'm not saying I agree with it. I'm just saying like it's very plainly there in the text of the movie. And I found it to be like one of the movie's major themes.
Yeah. I was going to say, famously British director David Lean is the one saying this. Yeah. I mean, because in the end, the best people to critique a culture are the people within the culture,
mm-hmm.
right?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that sometimes you can take it too far. But what I think that Lean does here is point out the continuing fact that British interests overseas are never necessarily for the betterment of the people who live in those countries.
Mm-hmm.
And you get the feel of that. And I think that's why I really appreciate Prince Faisal so much, you know, played by Alec Guinness. I think that there's an element of honor and dignity and intelligence and cunning to him that is only matched by the other British high authorities in this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's Lean's way of kind of saying like, yes, the British are cunning and bad and the conquerors, but the Arabians have a defender of their own who can match them wit for wit.
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of a subtle way of him saying like, yeah, what the British is doing isn't great, but every country has its intelligent people that can work, you know, the political realm like a chessboard.
Mm-hmm.
And I really enjoyed the character of Prince Faisal, especially with those last few scenes that you have with him.
Yeah, because he really disappears from the movie for like the whole second half of the film. And then he comes back in at the end of the movie and you realize he's kind of been pulling strings the whole time. And mm-hmm. it's a great performance by Alec Guinness. Again, like, let's get it out of the way now. Alec Guinness, a white guy playing an Arabian prince. You've got Anthony Quinn, an American, playing an Arabian. Like, yes, this would not happen today. I'm sure it's problematic in a lot of ways. But like the performance itself, it's a really, really great performance full of, like you said, there's a dignity to it. But then also there is an element of cunning to it. And yeah, I really loved Alec Guinness. I think this is a good place to get into talking about performances. I don't know that I want to start with Peter O'Toole because I have a lot of feelings about Peter O'Toole in this movie. But maybe let's start with the supporting cast, Brad. Who's somebody that you would want to point out?
I mean, I think that Omar Sharif is the second lead in this film.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he does just an excellent job of being a counterpoint to Lawrence's manic phases.
Yeah.
That he has an ability to point out the obvious, to keep him a little bit calmer than he might have been. And I think what I really appreciate is that the chemistry between Lawrence and Ali is such that they have such animosity the first time they meet. And you see the arc of their friendship grow and they trust one another more and more. And it's not just I didn't trust him. Now something happened and he saved my life. And now I trust him implicitly.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I feel like you would get that out of a lot of other movies. this movie doesn't do that. Because it takes 17 hours to watch the movie, you have time to watch them grow and develop a friendship where they trust one another. And so I think that the acting of Omar Sharif in this is really impeccable.
I think Omar Sharif he gives the best performance in the whole movie. And he does a lot with a little, especially in the first half of the film. The second half, they allow him to really flesh out his character, but he never gets the, you know, I'm going to run off behind a rock and brood thing that Peter O'Toole gets like eight times in this movie.
Or dance around in a circle with his new clothes.
Yeah, he doesn't get those scenes. And so he's not as, I don't want to say he's not as complex of a character, but he's not immediately given those moments to like show his layers. And it's not really until the last hour or so of the movie when Lawrence starts really breaching his own ethical code that Sharif Ali gets to be the conscience of the movie. And I think Omar Sharif really just excels in those scenes. I think another really great performance is Anthony Quinn as Auda Abu Tayyi. And people point to this performance as like the hammiest performance in the movie. And I guess it kind of is, but he's the hothead, right? Like, we're going to watch some Kurosawa movies at some point, Brad. In a lot of Kurosawa's samurai movies, the character that Toshirô Mifune plays is always like this character. He's the hothead. He's over the top. He's super animated. He's often uses comic relief for good portions of the movie. But he also is someone who is a man of convictions and who understands the political climate. And what I really love about this movie is that at no point does it allow you to fall under the impression that Lawrence initially has, which he calls the Arab people greedy, barbarous, and cruel. He calls them a silly people, a little people. And the movie's like, absolutely not. This guy has no idea what he's talking about. And we're going to show you exactly why it is a problem that the British are this arrogant coming into this area of the world, because they just don't know what they're getting into.
Yeah, I think that one of the most important takeaways from this film is the fact that just because you might have artillery, you know, more advanced technology, does not make you morally or ethically superior to other peoples of the world. And yet the British continually think that they have the upper hand on everything compared to these Arabian tribes. And I agree with you. I think that Anthony Quinn portrays a fierceness in his character that shows how loyal and careful and cunning he is at protecting his tribe's history and heritage and drawing them forward into the future, but carefully.
Yeah.
And not in such a way that it destroys who they are as a people group.
Well, and I think that, like, going back to Alec Guinness's character, Prince Faisal, that's the best encapsulation of this whole thing, right? And you see it in next week's movie, The Bridge on the River Kwai, in that the Japanese who are running the prisoner of war camp leverage the British's, like the British troops, I don't know what the word is. I don't call it arrogance, but like their need for civility and their need to think that they can bring civilization, they leverage that against them and get them to build this bridge under their own accord that they should never be building. And it's the same thing here. The first time you see Prince Faisal, Lawrence is kind of riding up over this mountain range, and you see that they're getting like dive bombed by these airplanes. And the British officer who's stationed there is complaining to Lawrence and says, like, I told him to move farther inland or downstream or whatever he says. And he's like, they need to move out of range. And he won't do it because he doesn't understand what artillery is. And the farther you get into the movie, the more you realize that what Alec Guinness's character, Prince Faisal, is doing is he's waiting for the opportunity for the British to think that this is their idea and to allow the British to take all the credit and to, you know, have these military victories and these parades thrown in their own honor to give him what he ultimately wants at the end of the movie. He totally uses their own arrogance against them. And he does the same with Lawrence. And again, it gets back to this theme of like, hey, we British people think we know everything and we really don't.
Mm-hmm. And I think, I don't know, if I can get a little bit controversial here, Bob, I think that's why it's so important to look past the surface level of a lot of movies, Because I feel like a lot of people might look at this film and go, oh, Alec Guinness, famously white British man, is playing an Arabian, and that's bad, and so the movie's bad. And, you know, while is there a reality where if you remade this movie, you could have any number of great Arabian actors play him? Sure. Like, I don't think that's a bad thing to do that, but I think it's also a bad thing to dismiss this movie on that, on those grounds. I think that there's so much to be gained from this film, and when you really spend time with it, you realize how countercultural this film was to be released in 1962, only, you know, like 20 years after World War II and only 40 years after World War I. Like, most of the people who are watching this movie would have been alive when these events were happening. So, like, this movie is incredibly countercultural for the decade that it came out in.
Absolutely. Well, and I want to tease our discussion of Peter O'Toole by pointing out one of my favorite moments in the movie, and it's when Prince Faisal keeps Lawrence back in his tent and starts to kind of plant that little worm in his ear. And he says, in order to be great again, Arabia needs the English. Or, and then Peter O'Toole goes, or what? And he says, or a miracle. And that's when Lawrence decides, I'm going to do this thing.
Because, I'm going to be that miracle.
And it's because he does not want to identify himself with the British. Like, he thinks that he is something different, that he is something other, and in a lot of ways better. And that's why, you know, at the end of the movie, when he is completely defeated and humbled and says, like, I'm not a god, I'm just a man, he goes and tells that to General Allenby. And Allenby says, no, you're the most extraordinary man I've ever known. And it's a moment that kind of reminds me of the end of Young Adult, when Charlize Theron is like finally humbled and then somebody tells them what they want to hear. But even in that moment, he resolves himself not to do what the British want him to do, but to go to Damascus and take it over before the British get there as a way of saying F you to the British. And Alec Guinness recognizes that in Lawrence from the very, very beginning. And it's really not until the end of the movie that you come to understand, like, how early on this guy knew how to leverage that against him. And I think that Guinness plays it so well. And again, we'll talk about Peter O'Toole, but to his credit, he plays it really well also.
And I think that's the problem with a 4-hour epic. You almost, like, I didn't necessarily like think about that depth of development in Prince Faisal, but that's because I need to watch this movie probably 2 or 3 more times to really put the full picture together of everything that's happening. And if I'm being honest, I might watch this movie one more time in my lifetime.
Yeah.
You know, just at some point with my kids when they're in their teen years, just to be like, hey, we're going to watch this over the next 3 nights because it's Lawrence of Arabia. And,
right.
That might be the last time I ever watch this movie, Bob.
Well, also because we're canceling it because of the people who are playing the Arabians. And also because he comes right out. Prince Faisal comes right out and says he wants to make Arabia great again. So we've got MAGA in this movie, too. Like, we've... All right, man, it's time for us to take a break. Let's drink this Bushmills, a super thematically appropriate whiskey, right? What do you say we get to it, Brad?
Let's make Arabia great again, Bob.
Film and Whiskey Nation, do you ever think about awards? Of course you do. You drink whiskey and watch movies, which means that you know that nothing is validated until a group of random people say, hey, we love what you're doing. The awesome thing about Doc Swinson's whiskey is that it isn't just some group of schlubs that are giving them awards. They have been winning attention from some of the most important whiskey experts that you can imagine. They've been voted best distillery in Washington State by the New York International Spirits Competition. They've been voted the best independent bottler by the Ascot Awards, as well as the best finished bourbon from the Ascot Awards for their La Menta Exploratory Cask. Their Exploratory Cask series is where they release some of the most fascinating and adventurous experiments. If you're ever checking out Doc's lineup and see a white label, there's a really good chance that that's the only time you'll see that bottle, so make sure you snatch it up. Doc Swinson's has been offering just phenomenal finished and blended whiskeys for quite some time now. You can find them online at docswhiskey.com. That's docswhiskey.com.
All right, today we are checking out Bushmills Black Bush. This is completing the trilogy of Bushmills this season. I bought a bottle of Bushmills at holiday season a couple years ago, and it came with two little 50 ml samples of Red Bush and Black Bush. So we got three for the price of one here, Brad. I really loved the Red Bush a couple weeks ago. That was freaking fantastic. And essentially, you know, if I can oversimplify here a bit, Bushmills uses a blend of whiskeys that are aged in a combination of ex-bourbon barrels and ex-sherry casks. And what they did with Red Bush was only release the stuff that was aged in the bourbon barrels. And what they do with Black Bush is only release the stuff that was aged in the sherry casks. So this is an all-sherried Irish whiskey. It's 80 proof. It's, you know, like it's basically half of what you would get in a bottle of Bushmills.
Mm-hmm.
And having drank regular Bushmills and the Red Bush now, we thought that regular Bushmills was kind of meh. We thought that the Red Bush was fantastic. And so that does not give me high hopes for Black Bush, because something had to make Bushmills meh. And so I'm hoping this isn't like the counterbalance to how good Red Bush was.
Yeah, this honestly kind of reminds me, a few months back, we received a sample, and man, I can see the bottle in my head right now, but I can't think of the product, where they sent us their blended whiskey. It was an Irish Irish pot still.
Keeper's Heart. And,
Keeper's Heart, thank you. Where they sent us essentially their final product, and then a sample of each of the three things they use to make their product. And I feel like Bushmills took that idea and just made three products out of it.
Mm-hmm.
And honestly, I kind of like that. Like, it would be fun to do a flight, like, all right in a row of Bushmills, and then their Red Bush, and then their Black Bush.
Oh, we're kind of doing that. They're just, you know, spread multiple weeks apart. So
yeah, you know.
We're going to dive in here. I mean, I really don't have too much more to say. Like, it's everything that we said about Bushmills is true about this, except for the bourbon barrels part. It's aged for at least 3 years, as Irish whiskey is, triple distilled, as Bushmills advertises. Let's just dive in, man. What are you picking up on the nose of this Black Bush?
This one comes across extremely malty. And then I get a little bit of honey, some stone fruit, kind of like cherry-ish notes, and a little bit of vanilla on the back end. I think I would give it like a 7.5 on the nose. It's solid.
I do like this quite a bit. And it's got some like darkness. Like, there's a darker character to this than I would have expected. It is very malty. And on the back end, like where you got vanilla, I got some like brown sugar. Like, there is almost just a wisp of bourboniness to this, which is, I mean, obviously wrong. Like,
yeah,
but it's there for me. The sherry influence, I'm not getting so much sherry. It does definitely smell like there's some wine character, but it seems like a darker red grape on the nose than a sherry. And so, like, yeah, I understand why they labeled this as Black Bush now. I kept thinking, like, you know, sherry and the color black don't seem like they would go together to me, but this definitely has some darker character to it. I like that. I think this is a more interesting nose than the regular Bushmills. I'll also give it a 7.5 on the nose.
Yeah, and then as I got into the palate, there's some soft bits of vanilla and honey that keep coming through. For me, it was really a lot of malt on the palate. And then at the back end, I got some like nutty toffee notes going on, like almost like a caramelized, I don't know, almond or peanut that was interesting. It's falling off a little bit from the nose for me. I'll give it a 7 out of 10 on the palate.
Man, it was so weird. I took a sip as you were talking, and as each thing, like each revelation that came out of your mouth happened on my palate as you were saying it. It was very weird. It was like you were narrating my experience. Yeah, it's really
malty. I think
malty.
That means we've made it as whiskey tasters.
We have just like meshed into one consciousness now. Like, all right. So, yeah, it's really malty on the palate. There's a lot of prickliness to it. Like, it's got some heat for an 80 proof whiskey. It has the bitter smokiness of a peated scotch without the actual peat smoke. I don't know how to explain that, but like when it turns bitter in the way that like a really peaty scotch does. And then I swallowed and you said like, oh, it's got like a nuttiness. And I'm like, no, I'm not getting that. And then you said, oh, it's like caramelized. And right when you said that, I was breathing out and I breathed out this note of like caramel corn, And it just had, just this little bit of bourbon character hanging around the back end of this. It's really, really weird. I don't know where it's coming from. It doesn't make sense, but it's definitely there. I like this.
Go ahead. I think it's coming from the whiskey, Bob.
I think so, too. It was either the whiskey or the glass, you know?
Ah.
I'll give this a 7 out of 10. It's really good, but it's still not blowing me away.
Yeah, and for me, when I got to the finish, it slightly sours on the very back end. The maltiness just gets to be too much. It does leave a really nice kind of faint honey aftertaste that lasts for a while that I do enjoy. But once again, it's kind of coming down a little bit more. I'm going to give it a 6.5 on the finish.
Yeah, the second sip, I actually got that sourness right at the tip of my tongue, not on the back end. When I went to swallow, there was almost like a not a butter cookie, but like maybe a graham cracker kind of thing going on for me. It's interesting. I don't know that I would call it complex, but there are many different notes that are coming out on this whiskey that I didn't expect to be there. So it's certainly surprising. The finish is pretty nice. And, you know, again, we'll get to the price point in a minute here. But I think, if I'm being frank, both the Red Bush and the Black Bush are better than regular Bushmills. And I almost don't understand why they're continuing to sell the regular Bushmills at this point. Like, these are both markedly better than the White Label, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's interesting. I think that this one, for me, falls off a little bit. I honestly don't remember the White Label right now enough to make a comparison. I think the balance... did you give a finish score?
Oh, I'll give it a 7.
Okay. I think the balance for me is a 7. There's nothing crazy about this. Nothing like super complex, but there's enough going on flavor-wise that I'm like, okay, I see what you're doing here, Bushmills.
Yeah, I'll give it a 7.5 on balance. This is above average, and I'm always going to be a little bit influenced by the price, but you know, for what this costs, I mean, it's essentially the same as what you're going to be paying for the White Label. And it is much more complex than that. And so I really do feel like I need to reward it a little bit. So I'm going to give it a 7.5. And that brings us to value. Now, I do not have the price pulled up here on my screen, Brad. Do you know what it is in the state of Ohio?
Bob, it is $32.99.
Is it really?
It sure is.
That makes no sense because the Red Bush was $22.
Yep.
What the hell?
Maybe the bourbon barrels are a lot cheaper.
I guess, man. Like, all right. Well, that changes things a little bit. I thought this was going to be like almost a third less than it actually costs. And I need to sit with this for a second. So you give your value score because I need to recalculate here.
I give it a 6. Mm. I think this is a decent Irish offering, but it didn't really impress me enough in any one area to make it like stand out to give it like a 7 or an 8. I think that with the Bushmills Red Bush, you're really getting an incredible value. Whereas this, I'm like, eh. Like, I would go buy the Sexton any day of the week over this.
Yeah, and that's kind of the comparison here, right? Like, you're getting into Sexton levels of pricing. Now, I will say, you and I both really like the softness and the sweetness of Irish whiskey, and that's what the Sexton offers. This is like a scotch. This drinks more like a scotch. And it brings a spiciness and like a dark complexion to Irish whiskey that we don't typically get. And so I really actually appreciate that. And I would sing its praises a lot more if it wasn't $32. So I'm also going to give it a 6 on value, which brings me out to a 35 out of 50. Now, a 35 is where we typically start recommending, hey, you should give this a try at the bar, or you should go out and get a bottle of it. I actually think that I like this a little bit higher than my 35 would indicate, but that value score does take it down just a peg. If you're looking to get into Irish whiskeys and you ask me like, hey, what are 5 or 10 Irish whiskeys I should have on my bar? I actually think I might point you to this in addition to the Red Bush because it is so far out of the wheelhouse of what Irish whiskey typically tastes like. But I'm landing at a 35, and Brad, I'd be interested to hear what's your score and do you recommend?
I'm at a 34 out of 50, so very, very close to you, Robert. I think I don't recommend. Hmm. I think that when you have the Red Bush right next to it for $10 cheaper, it's just so easy to recommend that over this. Mm-hmm. And if you really enjoy that, then sure, go try the Blackbush. But for me, on the condition of like, this is the one whiskey I'm recommending, I don't think I'm going to recommend it, Bob.
Yeah, it's really hard to recommend because I don't know that I'd recommend you buying a bottle at 32. But a pour at the bar is going to be like 7 or 8. And that's, you know, a quarter of the price of the bottle. So mm-hmm. I'm not also not going to recommend you trying it at the bar. The problem is that I think it's a good whiskey, but
split it with a friend.
They've put it in such a price point that it becomes cost prohibitive, even though it's not an expensive whiskey, because I think that the flavor profile is close enough to being Scotch that you could sub in a cheap Scotch and basically approximate what this tastes like. And it's like, I really want to reward the fact that it's like, wow, you captured some Scotchiness here in an Irish whiskey, but I don't want to make people go pay $32 to do that. So we're coming out to a 34.5 out of 50 or a 69 out of 100.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, I think we're both going to not recommend, but for me, with the caveat that I actually think this is a really good whiskey. So like, if you see it at somebody's house and they want to give you a pour, absolutely. Like, it's not bad, and I would call it good. I just think there's better things you could spend your $32 on.
I don't know if there's very many whiskeys, if I was in that hypothetical situation, where I'd be like, no, I don't want that. No, thank you. If they offered me Canadian Mist, I would probably say no.
Yeah, I'd probably join you on that front. All right, man. What do you say we get back into talking about Lawrence of Arabia?
Dude, I'm just excited for two facts and a falsehood.
Me too.
All right, everybody. That was Bushmills Blackbush, a whiskey that we were... yeah.
Yeah, I'm not meh on it. Like, I really enjoyed this. But
I think I was a little softer than you.
Yeah,
the price
I just
point,
think
man.
They priced people out of this.
Mm-hmm.
What the hell, Bushmills?
Yeah.
Ugh.
We know what we're not priced out of, Bob. The absolutely free segment of our podcast called Two Facts and a Falsehood.
Two Facts and a Falsehood. I don't know what my record is anymore. Full disclosure, we always hit this
point in the season where you just forget.
Well, we also haven't recorded a regular episode in weeks. Like, we got a little bit ahead, and then we took a couple weeks off. We did some bonus episodes. I have no idea. I'm above 500, and that's all that matters to me.
I was going to say, I think this is movie like 21 or 22 in the season.
Yeah.
So I'm guessing that you're like 12 and 10. 13 and 9, something in that area.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure.
I do know that you lost last week.
All right. Well, you know, let's gloss over that fact. So this is the part of the podcast where Brad tries to stump me by presenting three items, all of them presented as fact, one of which is a complete falsehood that he has made up. So Brad, without further ado, hit me with your two facts and a falsehood.
Fact number one, the first time Peter O'Toole tried riding a camel, he chafed so badly that blood was oozing from his jeans. He finally mastered his camel riding technique by adding a layer of sponge rubber underneath the saddle.
Maybe he should have not tried riding the camel in jeans. I feel like that... I could have told you that.
You're not wrong. Fact number two, Peter O'Toole, being from balmy Ireland, was unused to the climate of the desert and passed out from heat exhaustion three times throughout the production of the film, which left the famously cantankerous Lean in a little bit of a fury.
Yeah, we're going to say he passed out from, quote, heat exhaustion and not from copious amounts of scotch.
Fact number three, Bob. In the actual Battle of Aqaba, T.E. Lawrence was nearly killed when his camel threw him after he accidentally shot it in the head. During filming of that scene, Peter O'Toole was nearly killed. A gunner rocket used to signal action in the first Aqaba take fired prematurely, and O'Toole was thrown by his panicked camel in front of the charging horses.
Wow. That sounds so involved that if you did make it up, I respect it. So I'm gonna say that's a truth just because I want it to be a truth. Number two is he passed out a lot. And number one was he chafed in his jeans. I mean, those are both plausible.
That's what I should have said. Fact number one, Peter O'Toole chafed in his jeans. Fact number two, he passed out. Fact number three, he almost died.
I'm going to say one is the falsehood.
That he was chafing.
Well, yeah, I mean, it's very plausible, but two is also very plausible, and I just feel like it's the lamest one, so I want to say that's true. But I'm going to say one's the falsehood.
One is not the falsehood, Robert.
Okay.
He actually did add a layer of sponge rubber under the saddle, completely of his own innovation.
Nice.
And the actual Bedouin tribesmen who were acting as extras nicknamed him Ab al-Isfanja, which means father of the sponge, because they all started doing the exact same thing.
That's awesome.
Yeah, tell me that's not the best.
That's really cool. So what was the falsehood?
That he was unused to the climate of the desert and passed out from heat exhaustion.
All right. You know, you wrote such a lame falsehood, man. I wanted to give you more credit than that.
Thanks, dude. When his camel threw him in the Battle of Aqaba scene, the camel was trained, and it actually, after panicking, it stood over top of him to protect him from the charging horses so they didn't trample him to death.
Wow. Good for that camel.
Yeah, good for it.
Huh. Well, I lost again today because I give you more credit than you deserve.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that.
Yeah. Thank you, Brad. Always a pleasure doing business with you.
All right. I want to talk about how I watched this movie, because we initially were going to record a few days ago and I was trying to get it in, and I found myself having to watch it with my daughter, who is almost 2 years old, and she, I literally gave her a video game controller, which she has seen me use from time to time, and I said, "Do you want to play a camel game?" And she said, "Uh-huh." And I said, "All right, you can sit on my lap and we're going to play a camel game." And I gave her a controller and we watched Lawrence of Arabia. And she is now obsessed. And she just comes up to me and goes, "Come game." And she wants to watch Lawrence of Arabia to play the camel game.
I just picture her like waiting with bated breath through all the scenes with like Claude Rains in the palace. Like where there's no camels until she finally gets that sweet camel action again.
Yep. No, she literally, like, I was getting changed for work this morning and Haley was watching her. And I just hear Sadie like yelling it. And she runs out and she had found the controller from my desk and ran all the way to the back and was like looking me in the eyes with the dead set earnestness that only a 2 year old can muster, asking me to play the camel game. So it did make the movie watching experience a little more enjoyable.
There you go. All right. I think there's three things I want to make sure we touch on before we get out of here today. The first of which is we got to talk about Peter O'Toole, who I think gives a really good performance. And it's ultimately one of the most famous performances in cinema history just because of what this movie is. They put the title card on, you know, in the opening credits. It says, "An Introducing Peter O'Toole." Mm-hmm. It was not technically his first movie, but it was like his first big movie enough that anyone would have heard of him. And so, you know, to be doing a movie this big, this early in your career is truly a feat. And he does a fantastic job. Like, this is a hard character to play. And the fact that you never get to know Lawrence means that you have to play a ton of different emotions or no emotion at all in a way that makes somebody not be completely bored and turn it off or walk out of the theater. And I think he's to be commended for that. And I can't think of anybody else that I would rather have seen play this character. And at the same time, I wonder if I'm taking my annoyances with the character of Lawrence out on Peter O'Toole a little bit. But it's really hard to separate the performance from the character, or, you know, the lack of characterization there.
Honestly, Bob, I think when it comes to Peter O'Toole, I without actually saying the name, I kind of mentioned Gone with the Wind earlier by saying this is now the longest movie we've watched. Mm-hmm. I think that if there's a comparison to Gone with the Wind here, it's that I mentioned when we recorded that episode that it felt like the very first, like the grandfather of soap operas that Gone with the Wind did. Mm. And I feel like in this film, Peter O'Toole kind of feels like a soap opera actor for me. And I don't mean that in the sense of like bad acting, but I mean it in that he is just, he overplays so many of his emotions throughout the film, and they seem to come out of nowhere. And that's the frustrating part about this performance for me, that I'm not even sure if it's his fault or if it's Lean directing him or if it's what the script was asking him to do. But it feels like out of nowhere, he'll become wildly excited and crazy and just have these wonky ideas where he's like, yeah, we're just going to sneak into this Turkish-held town and I'm going to get captured and it's going to go great. And you're like, wait, I don't think it's going to go great. And then it doesn't go great. And then he wants to quit. And then he gets told that he's a god and he's suddenly wildly excited and happy again.
But that's like a script. That's a script issue. You know what I mean? That's not Peter O'Toole necessarily. Or are you saying the way he plays that?
But it's the way he plays it as well. Like, and like I said, I think it's the script asking him to do that. But I don't know. For me, it just felt like he vacillated between so many different emotions throughout the film that it felt soap opera-y to me, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, man. I think that's kind of where I'm at with this portrayal. It's a great performance. And at the same time, it's like I have thoughts or I have conflicted feelings about it. And it's unresolved. Like much of this movie, it's unresolved. And I think maybe we should segue into the other couple things that we need to hit on, one of which is David Lean, the director. This is the pinnacle of his career. But I mean, you know, it's rated as the number 5 greatest film of all time. And he never quite reaches these heights again. And we're going to kind of slowly walk backwards in his career from here. I just want to spend a couple minutes talking about like the technical amazingness of this movie, because, you know, the scene where Omar Sharif enters the movie, where it's just like a 2-minute silent sequence of you watching somebody emerge from the heat rising off of the sand in the distance. Like they had to make a special lens for this camera to shoot that far away. And it's a lens that's never been used before or since in motion picture history. And it captured one of the most famous sequences ever. And it's just kind of like, this is what David Lean was doing with this movie. He made a movie that no one else before or since could have made or has even tried to make. And there's been so much ink spilt on this topic that we're not going to say anything new or amazing about, like, new or noteworthy about it. But you can't talk about this movie without talking about what an achievement it is technically.
Yeah. I think that for me, I was reading Ebert's review of this that he wrote in 1989 after they re-released it. And I'm just going to read what he says. He says, I've noticed that when people remember Lawrence of Arabia, they don't talk about the details of the plot. They get a certain look in their eyes as if they're remembering the whole experience and have never been able to quite put it into words. And then he goes on to say, it is spectacle and experience, and its ideas are about things you can feel, not things you can say. And I think that that's the key. You know, he goes on and says at the end of this paragraph, much of its appeal is based on the fact that it does not contain a complex story with a lot of dialogue. We remember the quiet, empty passages, the sun rising across the desert, the intricate lines traced by the wind and the sand. And I think that's like the perfect understanding of this movie. For me, there's so many moments where he has these vast, you know, spectacular shots of the desert. And what I think he does really well is that he gives you a sense of the scale by giving you multiple points of reference. Like there's a small little rocky outcropping in the foreground, and then you have a vast desert plain and, you know, tiny specks that are Lawrence and Omar Sharif on camels going across the desert. And then there's a mountain immediately behind them, and then another mountain way off in the distance behind that. And it's like having these 4 to 5 different levels of what's the word I'm looking for?
Yeah, like
not a, like
I was going to say Vista, but yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, you know, not like a vanishing point.
Yeah, like a horizon.
I don't know. Yeah, there's so many different layers to it that without even realizing it, the viewer gets a sense of just how massive the obstacle of the desert is. Mm-hmm. And it's just a beautiful film, Bob.
Oh, yeah. I mean, like, again, like we're not going to get into talking about what 70 millimeter is compared to 35 millimeter or whatever. But like, it's just an unbelievably pristine looking movie after they restored it. Like, it is one of the most beautiful films I've ever seen, not just because of the composition of each and every shot. And it leads me into my last point, because you skipped a couple sentences in the middle of that paragraph, and Ebert talks about how Lawrence of Arabia, on its surface, it seems like a traditional movie, kind of like Bridge on the River Kwai. And we're going to talk about Bridge on the River Kwai next week, but I think it's so interesting to hold these two movies up next to each other. And it gets to this point that has been at the forefront of stupid conversation for 3 years now on the internet about Marvel movies and Martin Scorsese, and how Scorsese said that he doesn't consider Marvel films to be cinema. He says, you know, they have their place, but they're not cinema. And people have been struggling to define what's the difference between film and cinema or movies. And should we even draw that distinction? But Ebert kind of says it like this when he's comparing this movie to Bridge on the River Kwai. He says, although it seems to be a traditional narrative film like Bridge on the River Kwai, which Lean made right before it, it actually has more in common with such essentially visual epics as Kubrick's 2001 A Space Odyssey. And I read that and I was like, I get it now. I get my problems with this movie, because 2001 is a very difficult nut to crack. And it is an impenetrable movie. And a lot of people think it's the best movie ever made. And I have very well documented struggles with that movie. But I think that this movie toes the line between being a traditional entertainment and being a Gone with the Wind Hollywood kind of epic, and also being like this cinematic force that 2001 is, where it's not just about the storytelling, it's not just about having a good time and being entertained, but it's like, this is something that could only happen in this specific medium. You couldn't take Lawrence of Arabia and chop it up into four episodes and make it a Disney Plus show. It wouldn't work the same way. Like, there's something about the fact that this is cinematic that makes it what it is. Whether or not I actually enjoy it as much as I enjoy Bridge on the River Kwai, spoiler alert, I don't. I like that movie better than this. But there's, I understand why people rank this as the fifth highest movie ever, right up there with a 2001, because there is something about it that is just mysterious, and it has this pull to it. And it's the pull that you only get with that thing that Scorsese calls cinema. And I guess I just really want to hear your thoughts on that as we kind of move into final scores. Do you understand what I'm saying? I feel like I don't have language for this thing I'm trying to describe, but I'm starting to understand what that means when people make that distinction.
Yeah, I think that it's, in essence, it's a movie that justifies the existence of film as a medium. That, like, you couldn't have a book create the vistas for you that you get in Lawrence of Arabia. You couldn't have a radio broadcast that would describe the majesty of what you see in Lawrence of Arabia. That there's no other way to communicate it other than through film. And I think you can say that about 2001 A Space Odyssey. You can say it about Lawrence of Arabia. And it's something you can't really say about modern epic films. Like, and so I think that what Lawrence of Arabia does really is that. It's a movie that justifies movies being in existence in the first place. And you understand why critics of films rave over films like this.
Do you rave over films like this?
I liked it a lot, Bob.
Yeah.
I've really enjoyed it. I don't think I would put it as like a top five all time for me. But honestly, in the end, I mean, we have to do, let's make it a double before we get into final scores.
Oh, yeah,
but,
yeah, okay.
And I think with let's make it a double, you know, Bob, I don't know if you put any time or thought into it. I put hours and hours of thinking about it.
Right.
Obviously.
In addition to the 4 hours you spent watching the film.
Exactly. Right. Yeah, for sure. I think for me, I'm going to point out another older film. I think you should pair this with The Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
Nice.
I think that one has a little bit more dynamic relationships going on, but it has a similar sense of view and respect for terrain and what, you know, where they are filming that you have here in Lawrence. So yeah, I think I'm going to pair it with Treasure of the Sierra Madre.
I think I'm going to take the easy way out and go with Ebert and say 2001, because there's a lot of thematic similarities. There's, you know, the solitude and isolation of space. There's the unknowability of whatever the hell's going on in 2001 with the unknowability of T.E. Lawrence. This is a much more conventional movie than 2001, but I love that Ebert says that it's essentially a visual thing. And whatever's happening at the end of 2001, it is a visual and to some extent auditory experience that you only get in the medium of cinema. And this is like that. I mean, you know, I watched it on the biggest screen I could in my house, Brad, and like that, it pales in comparison to what it would be like to watch this in a movie theater. Like, there's just some sort of like weird alchemy that happens with movies like 2001, like Lawrence of Arabia, that draws you in, that makes you question in a way that only movies can do. And so I think 2001's a really good comparison.
Well, that gets us into our final scores. Bob, I think I'm going to give this movie an 8.5 out of 10.
Oh, hot take.
I really enjoy the film. I think that the struggles with how long it is and Lawrence's character, not necessarily with Peter O'Toole's performance, just with the character of T.E. Lawrence, I really struggled with the decisions he makes and the wild shifts in personality that you get. And that kind of like drew me back a little bit. But man, if it's not one of the most beautiful movies I've seen.
I'm just going to say up front that I just finished watching Bridge on the River Kwai. And Bridge on the River Kwai is like this interesting middle ground between Lawrence of Arabia and like The Great Escape, where it's a movie made by a really artistic eye. And so like it kind of straddles both it straddles that line. I'm going to give Bridge on the River Kwai an equivalent or higher score than I give Lawrence of Arabia. But I also completely understand why, you know, when the British Film Institute's Sight and Sound poll comes out at the end of this month, Lawrence of Arabia is probably going to be in the top 10 movies of all time. And Bridge on the River Kwai is going to be nowhere to be seen on that list. Like, I get it. I get why people worship this movie. But at the end of the day, like, there's only so much you can praise a movie and then say, like, hey, I just didn't enjoy it as much as I enjoy other movies that are meant to be enjoyed. And so I'm going to give it a 9 out of 10. And that makes our final score way lower than I expected to see next to the name Lawrence of Arabia. But that brings us out to an 8.75 out of 10. If you've seen Lawrence of Arabia, we'd love to know what you think. Are you like, do you think we're crazy? Is it one of the 5 best movies ever made? Is it overrated? You know, we can start those hot takes if you'd like to. You can let us know what you think of the movie by reaching out to us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or TikTok at Film Whiskey.
Or you can reach out to us on Discord. We are on there every single day talking to you guys, the fans of the Film and Whiskey podcast. So if you want to have a conversation with us in real time, you can find a link to our Discord at the end of every single one of our show notes.
We will be back next week to talk about this movie that I've been teasing this whole week, The Bridge on the River Kwai. But until then, I'm Bob Book.
I'm Brad G.
And we'll see you next time.